This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, January 22, 2010. In New York, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up on today's newscast, another aftershock rocks Port-au-Prince as residents continue to make do with scarce shelter and aid. We'll examine the implications of yesterday's Supreme Court ruling that allows corporations to put big money into politics. And today marks the deadline set by President Obama to close the Guantanamo Bay detention facility. It's still open, and now the administration says around 50 inmates may remain indefinitely. Those stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Progressives say goodbye today to what had become a fixture of lefty political talk.
Air America Radio. Real facts in a filtered world.
The radio network announced that it will soon file for Chapter 7 bankruptcy. It says it will shut down its network feed on Monday night. In a statement on its website, network leadership says Air America got caught up in a perfect storm of a poor economy, falling ad revenues, competition from new media, and cash flow problems. Air America, which began broadcasting in 2004, eventually found audiences on 100 stations nationwide. The trial of Afia Siddiqui continues today. Siddiqui is the Pakistani scientist accused of shooting at her U.S. military and CIA captors in Afghanistan in 2008. Several government witnesses have testified in the Manhattan federal court trial, but have presented differing versions of what happened. FSRN's Salim Rizvi reports from New York.
Six government witnesses have testified in the trial so far, including the FBI lead investigator and an Afghan interpreter, who was one of the eyewitnesses. But the accounts of the shooting have differed in information as basic as Siddiqui's location during the incident and whether she was standing or kneeling when she allegedly fired the M4 rifle. Tina Foster is the family spokesperson of Afia Siddiqui.
There were dozens of people in the room, in a tiny small room, when this incident supposedly happened, and nobody saw her do the shooting other than one individual who is the Afghan translator. You know, I think it's clear that as a result of his version of events that he obtained the fastest visa in green card in American history, and clearly he accepts the fact that it was a thank you.
The trial has been marked by threats of boycott by Siddiqui and several angry outbursts in the courtroom. She has denied all the charges. Salim Rizvi, FSRN, New York City.
In Sri Lanka, a bomb attack caused major damage, raising fears that escalating violence could mar the presidential election next Tuesday. This is the first national election since the defeat of the Tamil Tiger rebels in decades of war. FSRN's Ponia Manikavasagam reports from Sri Lanka.
In this latest incident, a bomb damaged an opposition candidate supporter's car and house. The attack came just days after UN head Ban Ki-moon appealed for calm ahead of next week's presidential poll. The incumbent president Mahinda Rajapaksa is facing former army commander Sarath Fonseca for the country's top elected position. Keithi Tenakon is the director of Campaign for Free and Fair Elections, known as CAFE.
CAFE has so far received 4 complaints, incidents of election-related deaths, assassinations, of course, and 80 people have wounded, and that figure itself says the gravity of the situation.
The forerunners, Rajapaksa and Fonseca, are at the height of popularity because of their role in defeating the Tamil Tigers last May. The Tamils don't have a candidate in the presidential race. Ponnaiah Manikavasagam, FSRN, Sri Lanka.
Today, Washington's peace envoy George Mitchell failed to lure Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas back to the negotiating table. FSRN's Rami Almagari has more.
Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas stuck to his demand that Israel should freeze all settlement activities in the West Bank and the East Jerusalem, land he wants to be part of a Palestinian state. Top negotiator Saeb Erekat says Palestinians want the peace talks to resume from the point they stopped in December 2008, when a complete settlement halt was still on the table. Israeli media reports that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has placed one more condition on restarting peace talks. If Palestinians achieve statehood, Israel would be able to keep some territory within the state for security reason. Mitchell met with Israeli leadership yesterday. Rami Al-Mighari, Free Speech Radio News, Gaza.
And finally, today is the 37th anniversary of Roe v. Wade. Both pro-life and pro-choice groups are planning marches in several cities this weekend. Today also marks the opening of the trial of Scott Roeder, the man accused of killing Dr. George Tiller, an abortion provider in Kansas. In a controversial decision last week, the district judge allowed Roeder to try for an involuntary manslaughter conviction instead of first-degree murder. If convicted of the lesser charge, Roeder would only serve 4 to 6 years in jail. And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News from Eugene, Oregon. I'm Jess Burns.
This is Dorian Marina in New York. A 4.4 magnitude earthquake shook Port-au-Prince this morning as rescue workers start to wind down their efforts to search for trapped survivors. Meanwhile, aid continues to trickle into the makeshift tent cities housing hundreds of thousands of survivors. An estimated 200,000 Port-au-Prince residents have fled to other parts of Haiti. That's according to the U.S. Agency for International Development. FSRN spoke to Oxfam International's incoming country director for Haiti, Claude St-Pierre, yesterday evening in Port-au-Prince. He said he had just visited several hospitals where Oxfam delivered bottled water and supplies. The organization is working at 7 sites across the capital. St-Pierre said shelter is a primary concern for the country's more than 1.5 million left homeless by the quake.
Our approach to shelter so far has been to, in these immediate sort of circumstances, to try to provide people with something to cover them. We had rain a few nights ago. We were very concerned that people did not have, for example, plastic sheeting, like simple means to just, you know, have a bit of a roof over their head. And that goes as much for the people who are in these agglomerations, who've lost completely their houses, as well as the people who haven't lost completely their houses but are feeling insecure to return to their houses.
Meanwhile, the communications infrastructure of Port-au-Prince remains unreliable. Telephone service is spotty and internet access is extremely limited. This has made coordinating a response to the disaster especially challenging for relief organizations. But for the city's residents, it's also been hard to get information or connect with loved ones. Many are tuning into the radio for information. Ansel Hurst reports from Port-au-Prince.
Throughout the quake's aftermath, the voices of many Port-au-Prince radio stations have been loud and clear. Radio Solidarite 88.5 FM is one of the outlets to survive the earthquake. They resumed broadcast from their small studio at the top of a two-story building in the city center once they found some gas for their generator just 2 days after the quake. Gas to generate electricity is still difficult to find, but the Radio Solidarite staff are able to use their undamaged studio.
We have tried to tell the population to be strong. We appreciate their courage. The international press was talking about violence, but we didn't see any. The help is very slow at times, and people get angry. Our work is to say, let's be calm.
Radio Metropole, one of Haiti's biggest stations, also began broadcasting as soon as they found gas. Other than scattered records on the floor of its music room, the facility was not affected. Still, the staff don't feel safe broadcasting from inside their one-story compound.
We can't broadcast from inside, but we put our studio outside and let it free to the population so they can come and say anything they want to say and give any information about their lives they want to provide us, and to let them tell the whole world what's happening in Haiti.
Jerome Richard is a veteran reporter for Radio Metropole. On Thursday, he interviewed the mayor of Delma, one of the hardest-hit zones in Port-au-Prince, under a tent in the station's yard.
The goal is still the same. It hasn't changed. It is to make the maximum amount of people know what's happening with our reporters that are on the streets, in the countryside. We in the studios, the journalists, we do our best to let everyone, including Haitians, know what's happening. We broadcast their messages because it's a way to help them face their challenges.
Staff with Radio Telegonen said they had the same mission, but their three-story building, which also houses a TV studio, fell on its side. One of its walls crumbled, leaving a gaping hole. On Wednesday, Edna Jean and several other volunteers emerged from the building's rubble, unable to retrieve the body of a young cameraman. the station's only casualty.
We're helping Radio Teleguinen because we love Radio Guinan. We love all its programming, and it also serves us. We're doing our best to pull a person out. We're on our own. Since the disaster happened, nobody's come to help us.
A crane belonging to a Haitian construction company sits yards away from the rubble, across from people camped out in hundreds of tents. Jean Bourget, the station's owner, says no one there knows how to operate it, but he's confident that they'll begin broadcasting within days.
We are the People Radio. Very soon, we'll be back on the air. Our antenna is already here, right here, and we just got a new generator. Our generator collapsed with the building. We save as much as equipment that we can. But our reporters start already working, so we'll be back very soon.
In the heart of Cité Soleil, Radio Boukman is on the air. The station is named after the voodoo priest who helped ignite Haiti's slave revolt. The remains of a police station are piled next to their building, but the station itself only lost some equipment that fell off shelves. Authorities say they're concerned with security for aid distributions inside the Oceanside shantytown. Edwin Adrien, a producer for the station, said nobody from the UN or the United States contacted them to coordinate aid.
I don't know until now why they don't contact any entities, especially Radio Boukman. I don't know the reason, but they didn't contact us yet. I think the information that we are broadcasting is helping everyone, including Minutsa and the population. We have to keep the population informed.
Port-au-Prince suffered another aftershock Friday morning, but parts of the city are gaining some semblance of normality. The sound of Creole songs, hip-hop, and the latest news helps to ease the tension in the city's air. Ansel Hurst, FSRN, Port-au-Prince.
Thursday's Supreme Court ruling on corporations' rights to finance elections has already inspired a protest movement. Activists launched the Campaign to Legalize Democracy just hours after the decision came down. Their goal is nothing less than the abolition of corporate personhood, the idea that corporations have the same constitutional protections as human beings. Tanya Snyder has the story.
Corporate personhood can sound like a strange concept, leading some to question how huge multinational, multi-billion dollar corporations can have the same constitutional rights as human beings.
The idea of corporate constitutional rights is nowhere in the Constitution. The Constitution is completely silent about the role corporations should play.
David Cobb was the Green Party presidential candidate in 2004 and represents the Program on Corporations, Law, and Democracy and the Campaign to Legalize Democracy.
The idea that concentrated capital can claim such a right is patently absurd, and it makes democracy basically illegal if we, the people, cannot create the kind of economic institutions that we need to accomplish and create the world in which we want to live.
The 14th Amendment to the Constitution defined the civil and political rights of citizens. This same amendment, which clarified the rights of African Americans, has also long been interpreted as justification for giving personhood rights to corporations. Of course, corporations don't have the same limitations as human beings.
Obviously, things like the death penalty can't be applied to a corporation. A corporation can't be imprisoned. I mean, they're not human beings. But for things like free speech, they are a group of individuals.
Ilya Shapiro of the libertarian Cato Institute agrees with the Supreme Court's interpretation of corporations as just a group of individuals.
I don't see why there should be a difference under the law, and the Constitution says there's not, between one individual amassing a lot of wealth and spending money on political speech, or two individuals getting together the same thing, or five, or 10, or 50 getting together and filing for corporate status.
Democracy activists see the Citizens United decision as the worst possible outcome of the case. Ben Mansky directs the Progressive Liberty Tree Foundation.
The majority opinion very clearly relied on the doctrine of corporate personhood to settle in their minds once and for all this question of whether corporations are entitled to government protection against we the people.
The implications go far beyond campaign finance, the core issue of the case. Mansky says lobbyists are already making their case against President Obama's proposed tax on big banks based on this ruling.
In order to be successful in bringing this challenge to strike down a tax that goes after the big banks and not the small community banks, they would have to have established that corporations were persons under law. And that's exactly what Citizens United did.
Communities fighting corporations over pollution or wages or health and safety come up against roadblocks time and time again. George Friday is national coordinator of the Independent Progressive Politics Network, one of the organizations that formed the campaign to legalize democracy. She's worked with community organizations around the country, from the Gulf Coast to North Carolina hog farmers.
And often in situations where there's no one that they can hold accountable, no one's name that they could put on anything, they wind up chasing a ghost, and decades will pass. And by then, of course, the people who have been severely damaged don't have the energy to fight anymore. Corporations know that they can outweigh any community, even an organized community, and especially a low-income community or communities of color. They just wait it out, always hiding behind corporate personhood.
The campaign to legalize democracy has nearly 18,000 signatures on their online petition to ratify a constitutional amendment clearly stating that corporations are not entitled to the same rights as human beings. Tanya Snyder, FSRN.
Plaintiffs suing to overturn California's ban on same-sex marriage closed their case today, ending 2 weeks of testimony that included academic experts, lesbian and gay witnesses speaking about the effects of anti-gay discrimination, and even a proponent of the Proposition 8 ban on gay marriage. Judge Vaughn Walker is hearing the Perry v. Schwarzenegger trial in a federal district court in San Francisco. Christopher Martinez files this report.
One of the five official proponents of the measure to ban same-sex marriage took the stand Thursday as a hostile witness called by the plaintiffs over the objection of the Proposition 8 defense lawyers. Hak-Shing William Tam is a Chinese evangelical pastor who organized rallies for Prop 8, debated the measure at the request of the campaign, created a website to support it, and even joined the lawsuit as a defendant. In a letter to Chinese churches, he wrote that if the measure failed, quote, other states would fall into Satan's hand. He also called same-sex marriage part of a gay agenda he learned about on the internet, an agenda he says includes legalizing prostitution and sex with children. David Boies is the lawyer who questioned Tam on the stand on behalf of the plaintiffs. He calls Tam's testimony a clear window into the mentality of Prop 8 supporters.
What he was putting out was some of the worst examples of attacks on homosexuals that you can imagine. Allegations that allowing same-sex marriage would increase pedophilia, would result in gays molesting children. His assertion that gays molested children 12 times as much as heterosexuals is directly contrary to all of the science and all of the studies.
Andrew Puno is a lawyer for the group Protect Marriage, the official campaign organization. He says Tam's testimony will become an issue when the judge's final ruling is appealed to a higher court.
You are witnessing history that somebody who supported an initiative is being put on the stand, like the Inquisition, and questioned about his political beliefs, as though his beliefs can be declared proper or improper and therefore strike down what 7 million voters decided on Election Day. This is a first in judicial history that I know of.
Tam's statements on the stand follow a week of testimony from plaintiff's witnesses, including Stanford political science professor Gary Segura, who spoke about anti-gay violence and deep animosity, and other factors that show lesbians and gays run more risk of being harmed than any other group in U.S. society. Cambridge psychologist Michael Lamb testified that children are not harmed by having gay parents. A motto of the Prop 8 campaign was, "Defend marriage, defend children." But plaintiff lawyer Theodore Boutros says Lamb's testimony destroyed a key argument for Prop 8.
Part of the campaign on Proposition 8 was the official material and the official statements that were made. And then there was the broader campaign where the ProtectMarriage.com and other organizations were disseminating these messages that are completely unscientific and include misleading and false statements regarding children and parenting. So Dr. Lamb, I thought, did a superb job of demonstrating why those points are false.
Proponents of Prop 8 will present their case next week, but so far they have only two witnesses lined up to testify. Unless they add more witnesses, the trial could end by the middle of next week. Whoever loses is likely to appeal the decision to a higher court, and ultimately to the U.S. Supreme Court. Christopher Martinez, FSRN, San Francisco.
Shortly after taking office in 2009, President Obama signed executive orders laying out a timetable to close the Guantanamo Bay detention facility within the year. The deadline was set for today, but the facility remains open. The Obama administration has also announced that around 50 of the nearly 200 remaining detainees may be held indefinitely without trial. Documented use of torture and religious abuse have taken place at the facility in the course of its 8 years of operation. This week, Harper's Magazine reports that the deaths of three detainees in 2006 may have occurred due to torture and interrogation. The U.S. government had previously called the deaths suicides. We're joined by journalist Andy Worthington, author of the book The Guantanamo Files and a co-director of the film Outside the Law, Stories from Guantanamo. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
It's very good to be here.
Let's begin by talking about the detainees themselves. Much of the attention has been put on prisoners who have either admitted connections to Al-Qaeda or 9/11, such as Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, or facing charges in criminal court. But as your film profiles, many of the men held at Guantanamo do not have ties to any terrorist organization. The evidence against them is conflicting or confusing. In fact, in some cases, their own lawyers haven't been told the specific charges against them. Tell us about some of these men.
The entire concept of who ended up in Guantanamo was devastatingly flawed from the beginning. Far from what the Bush administration claimed, which was that these were all, you know, the hardcore guys picked up off the battlefield, very few were picked up on any kind of battlefield. 86% of the prisoners, at least, were not captured by the U.S. military, but were captured by their Afghan or Pakistani allies. And this was a time when bounty payments were being made, averaging $5,000 a head, which is a considerable amount of money in Pakistan and considerably more in Afghanistan. And that absolutely led to Guantanamo filling up with what one of the first commanders there, Major General Michael Dunleavy, called Mickey Mouse prisoners. I mean, in 2002, when the prisoners were streaming in, he tried to address this. He said, "Would you stop sending me so many Mickey Mouse prisoners?" Those were his words.
Well, let's listen to a clip from the film Outside the Law, Stories from Guantanamo. This is a former detainee at Guantanamo Bay named Omar De Gaius talking about the conditions when he was first transferred to Guantanamo.
Say, one night they handed us, took us to the airport and then handed us to the American. Suddenly, you know, they said, "See, Americans shouting, you know, we're in a place like an airport, can hear the planes." And then suddenly, the hood we had, the Pakistani hood, was taken off to another worse hood than the first one. The first hood was very thin and you could have some air. It was a signal of a new, a real hardship.
That's a clip from the film Outside the Law, Stories from Guantanamo. Andy Worthington is a co-director along with Polly Nash. Securing legal rights for detainees has been a long process. There was a Supreme Court case in or decision in 2004 where the court said prisoners do have rights to habeas corpus. Where do things stand now?
Now, there have been 41 prisoners have had rulings made in their cases since then. And in 32 out of these 41 cases, the prisoners have won. The judges have granted them their habeas petitions. They have said, really pretty much justifying what I found from my research and what other people have found from studying it, that these were people about whom you knew nothing. And in order to construct a case against them, you have relied upon unreliable witnesses. You know, the court cases are persistently full of people making claims about other prisoners, even though various parts of the agencies and the authorities in Guantanamo have noted that these men are particularly unreliable. It just keeps happening over and over again. The only supposed evidence is the testimony of witnesses who are unreliable, or of the prisoners themselves, where they were, you know, coerced or tortured into making false confessions.
And finally, what needs to happen in order to close Guantanamo? President Obama has said that he wants to transfer detainees to the Thompson Correctional Center in Illinois. Would that remove the possibility of these abuses and restore a legal process? What needs to happen?
The bottom line is that the 198 people who are held, there are only about 40 who the government intends to put on trial. Now, that fits with all the figures we've been given over the years by intelligence officials who said, you know, no more than around 40 of these people had any meaningful connection to terrorism. What happens to the rest? There are too many cleared prisoners who can't go to their home countries, like the Uyghurs. And the obstacle that was put in place last year, you know, through President Obama's cowardice, and through the lawmakers who have tried to prevent any Guantanamo prisoner being brought to the mainland for any reason, is a major obstacle. To get these cleared men out of Guantanamo, I think it needs the United States to accept responsibility for its own mistakes and to bring some of those people there. You know, we've got a long way to go.
We've been speaking with Andy Worthington, author of the book The Guantanamo Files and co-director of the new film Outside the Law, Stories from Guantanamo. A link to his website and a link also to the article from Harper's Magazine is up on our website, fsrn.org. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
One obstacle to closing Guantanamo is the idea that those released would turn to terrorism. The Pentagon has said that there's data to support the claim, but as David Rosenfeld reports, a closer look at the accuracy of these claims raises some questions.
The day after President Obama announced the United States would stop releasing Guantanamo prisoners to the country of Yemen, a Pentagon spokesperson said the number of recidivist detainees, those who allegedly returned to terrorist activity, had increased to 20%. A similar claim in April through an unclassified report said 1 in 7 detainees likely returned to battle, while it named just 29. Now, the Defense Department says that number has risen to 1 in 5 without offering additional evidence. Recent press reports covering the Pentagon's claims cited unnamed sources, and last month, Pentagon Press Secretary Jeff Morrill confirmed the upward trend in recidivists at a press briefing. But Pentagon spokesperson Major Tanya Bradshaw said the recent 20% estimate is not a figure DOD has released. Bradshaw declined to go on tape for this story, but said the named individuals in the April report were meant to be a sample, and the rest of the names cannot be released for security reasons. Professor Mark Dembo, director of the Seton Hall Law School Center for Policy and Research in New Jersey, has analyzed all of the Pentagon's claims of Guantanamo recidivism and found them to be false.
This is their 46th time the government has spoken on the number on the question of recidivists. It's the fourth time the Department of Defense has. Their numbers have changed every time. At no point have they ever matched names with numbers. There is a following statement. We have no names. We have no numbers. We have approximate percentages for which we have some trends, and it's an inexact science.
In the last claim by the Pentagon in April, officials confirmed less than half and named only 15 of those confirmed suspects, two of which were never held at Guantanamo, according to Dembo. Dembo said releasing such information has succeeded in slowing down plans to close the prison.
It's kind of bizarre. It's almost as if the Defense Department is exaggerating and making up its failures rather than accurately reporting the truth. And whoever leaked this so-called story was very effective at making sure Guantanamo stayed open longer.
For the time being, the strategy is working. Roughly 90 of the remaining detainees are from Yemen, and close to 40 are cleared for release, according to the New York Times, but won't be sent home until the government re-examines its strategy. David Rosenfeld, FSRN.
And that wraps up today's program. This is Free Speech Radio News. Thanks for listening. In New York, I'm Dorian Marina.